The Tolkien Road, Episode 226, The Life of J.R.R. Tolkien, Part 4. Hello, everyone. Welcome to The Tolkien Road. John here. Greta, you were there. Hey. What's up?
I'm here, too. Yeah. What's up? Not a whole lot. I think my brain is just a little distracted. I'm super excited about playoff football today.
Yeah, I was just going to say, you wanted to get this, you wanted to get this recording session done early so that you could just plop on the couch and watch football this
pretty
afternoon.
Pretty much. Yep. So. Pretty much. That's my plan for the day. So yeah. We're going to make this snappy. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh, are we?
Yes, we are.
Well,
I mean, not overly snappy, but efficient, maybe. Oh,
yeah.
Bonus.
I guess I had it on repeat. Whoops. Whoopsie doodle.
Well, I mean, it is catchy and all.
Yes, it is.
I could listen to that.
I was thinking
repeat.
To myself, I think we are the only, I wonder, we just have to be the only Tolkien podcast with a, podcast about Middle Earth with a techno intro, you know, techno
Probably.
Theme song.
That I feel like thought hadn't occurred to me, but I bet
feel
you're
like
right.
Any of the other ones I listen to, it's a very different vibe in terms of the intro. So
it's more Enya-ish, maybe, or like maybe a little folksy. What do you think?
Probably Enya folksy. You know, that's probably more of the Tolkien vibe, mm-hmm. Middle Earth vibe, anyway. But
you know what? This suits us, though.
Yeah,
it suits what we're about. So
indeed,
I don't see any reason to change it.
Well, good, because we're not
good.
At least not this episode.
Okay.
Phew. Putting my foot down. My fist down for this episode.
It will stay as it is for now.
Yeah, so on this episode, this is episode 226, where you're discussing the life of J.R.R. Tolkien, part 4. This will be the last episode of our series on the life of J.R.R. Tolkien. We're going to examine the period of Tolkien's life from the publication of The Lord of the Rings through his death in 1973. So that is a plan.
Sounds good.
Before we get started, we'd like to give a shout-out to our patrons. As always, special thanks to this episode's executive producers, Caitlin of Tea with Tolkien, Lise Yu, and Andrew T.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you all so much. I also want to give a shout-out to our newest patrons, Richard K., Melanie N., and Scott W. Thank
Woo-hoo,
you for
welcome.
Becoming patrons.
Yes.
Thank you for your pledge of support.
Thank
really
you, guys.
Appreciate it.
We do.
And I want to give a shout-out to a couple of longtime patrons, Emilio P. and John R., They went for it, man. They both boosted and annualized.
Woo!
Boosted and annualized their pledges.
That's awesome.
That is awesome.
That's really, really cool.
So
thank you, guys.
If y'all were right here, I would give y'all both like double high fives, right?
Is that allowed anymore? Can we give high fives?
Why not? Yeah.
Corona.
Oh, well.
Maybe they need it. Maybe we should keep it to air fives or fist bumps.
Huh?
Or fist bumps, maybe. Air fives?
Well,
we could give them air fives right now, actually.
If you were, and if I wasn't, you know, I would give you double high
well,
fives.
Well, as would I. I'm just trying to...
And if you were okay with it, I would make sure and wash my hands very well before, if that makes you feel better.
Yeah.
Greta.
I'm sorry. I'm just trying to keep us, you know, what's the word? PC?
From getting
shut down?
From getting shut down by the CDC.
Well, podcast shut down for lack of intent of social distancing.
It ain't happened yet for all the damage we've done to everybody's mental health. So
well, that is
got
is
that
true.
Going for us.
That's true. Okay.
Yeah. So,
but I would be all about the high fives too.
Well, we can just do the virtual high fives right
yeah,
now.
Yeah, we can
so
do that.
Virtual high fives. Boom. Boom. There we go.
Okay.
You got to have the video. See, they're patrons, so they get to see the video of us doing that.
Oh, I forgot that. I wasn't even looking at the camera. I don't know what I was looking at. That's going to look weird to them now. Sorry, guys. At least you got my cool sound effect in there.
You can get the sound effect and the actual video of it if you become a patron yourself, because our patrons for... This hasn't become an official perk, but it might in the near future, but for the last several episodes, we've been doing video of our recordings here that our patrons get to watch.
Yeah.
So it's available to our patrons. So if you like that... If you want to see that, become a patron, and you got it. All right. You can... So, for the rest of this month, if you do an annual pledge, right, if you become a patron and do an annual pledge, then you get 2 months free, right? So let's say you wanted to become a $5 patron, right? So over the course of a year, if you were a patron for the whole year, that would be $60, right? Five times 12. But if you become an annual patron for the rest of this month, then you get 16% off, which is the equivalent of saving 2 months because you end up paying about $50. So,
all right.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
I think that's a good deal.
And it's a win for us because we know that your pledge is, you know, before it's like month to month. Okay. Is this person going to be here for the rest of it? But like with the annual pledge, it's like, I've made my pledge for the whole year, right? I'm a patron for the whole year. Mm-hmm. So
yeah, that's good stuff.
Win-win.
Yeah, definitely.
Win-win-win-win-win-win-win-win-win. Just winning all the time. Yeah. Okay. I like winning.
Who doesn't? Who doesn't?
Yeah.
Winning isn't everything, but losing sucks.
That's right.
So that's a good motto to live by.
That is. I was told that by a wise man once.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Support us on Patreon. Becoming a patron lets you support the show in a tangible way and land you some awesome perks like early access to new episodes and more. Head on over to patreon.com/TolkienRoad to find out the deets. You can also support us via tip jar, leave a tip. You can also subscribe, rate, and review us on iTunes and other podcasting platforms. Please leave us a 5-star rating and say some nice things about us.
You please.
Can, yes. Well, yeah. You can be like our friend on January 5th.
That's a cool name. I like that.
Who, I suppose that's probably just type in some stuff on the keyboard because I don't want to leave my real name. But they left us a really nice review. So the title of the review, 5-star review, informative and balanced. As a first-time reader of The Lord of the Rings, this podcast has given me deeper insight into the world of Tolkien and a fun way of dialoguing with it. While my faith was the road that led me to Tolkien, this and other sources gave me an appreciation for his work in and of itself. As a Catholic seminarian, I appreciate the strong case you make for religion as an influence of Tolkien's, as something fundamentally present in his writing, not just something religious people read into it. When Christian elements come up, you both are able to speak to them well without forcing it. Thanks for the podcast.
Ooh, nice.
Well, thank you.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you very much.
Person? Sorry.
Well.
Thank you. We don't know if it's a...
Well, you know, they said they're a Catholic seminarian. Oh. So last I checked,
look at you,
Catholic
Sherlock. Wow, you're on it. Call me. Well, I guess I'm not even your Watson now, am I? Because I didn't even pick up on that.
Well, it's
you're
all
right. You're just Sherlocking all by yourself.
I was just going to say, it's cool to hear from a Catholic seminarian.
It really is. It absolutely is. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's really cool. Thank you.
All about our seminarians. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Thank you very much for listening, and thank you very much for taking those steps towards service there. So really appreciate it.
Absolutely. I'm glad you're enjoying the podcast. Keep listening.
Absolutely.
Please.
Absolutely. All right. So we got some kind of big news this week. Yeah. I don't think I told you about this. Oh. So our friends over at the OneRing.net, right? You know, a good pal Clifford.
Yeah.
Over there, Clifford Broadway.
Yes,
I don't know if this is him speaking specifically, although I think it might be. But anyway, the OneRing.net got kind of an inside scoop this week, which they're kind of the place for Tolkien inside scoops, if you will. But they seem to have gotten an inside scoop this week on the official synopsis for Latron Prime, and then it was confirmed later that it is the official synopsis for the Latron Prime show.
Ooh.
So we have the official synopsis now,
synopsis?
People.
Synopsis?
Yes.
That's almost as good as a trailer.
Almost as good. We're not quite there yet, but this is pretty big. So I'm going to read it. But Greta, what we're going to do, because this is big news. So what we're going to do is after this episode's done, we're going to record a short bonus episode for our YouTube channel where we're going to react to the news, right? We're going to kind of, so.
But it's not going to be genuine because we're going to react to it here.
No, I mean, I'm just saying like, we're going to kind of
talk about
it
more.
In a little more depth, right?
I see. Okay.
See, Greta was thinking that meant that we were just going to go over there and be like, blah, you know, like.
Pretty much.
And
I was like, where's my party hat?
No,
what is it? Tutors? Not tutors. You know those?
Oh, tutors.
What are they called?
Yeah.
Yes.
Pew, pew, pew. Yeah.
All right,
so.
Sorry. Back on track. So we're going to do a bonus episode.
Yes, we're going to do a bonus episode where we discuss the official synopsis, but I'm going to go ahead and read it here, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So, or do you want to read it?
I'll read it.
Okay, you
read
it. So this is via the OneRing.net. So hat tip to the OneRing.net.
All right, here we go. Amazon Studios' forthcoming series brings to screens for the very first time the heroic legends of the fabled Second Age of Middle-Earth's history. This epic drama is set thousands of years before the events of J.R.R. Tolkien's The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings, and will take viewers back to an era in which great powers were forged, kingdoms rose to glory and fell to ruin, unlikely heroes were tested, hope hung by the finest of threads, and the greatest villain that ever flowed from Tolkien's pen threatened to cover all the world in darkness. Beginning in a time of relative peace, the series follows an ensemble cast of characters, both familiar and new, as they confront the long-feared re-emergence of evil to Middle-earth. From the darkest depths of the Misty Mountains to the majestic forests of the elf capital of Lindon, to the breathtaking island kingdom of Numenor, to the furthest reaches of the map, these kingdoms and characters will carve out legacies that live on long after they are gone.
Boom.
And there's a big old green confirmed stamp.
That's right.
At the very bottom. So it's legit.
If we could narrate that, then it would be like, whoopsh, confirmed.
We're all about sound effects so far today. We're really good. That was a really good one. I like that.
Thanks.
You're welcome. I really appreciate
you complimenting my sound effects.
My goal in life
is to become like the guy from the Police Academy movies, you know, who does all the sound effects.
I didn't know that. But you're well on your way.
You've probably never even seen... I'm not sure that I have, actually.
Yeah.
Well, I'll have to show you what I'm talking about there. Okay. But I'm sure there's some people out there that know what I'm talking about.
I'm sure there are.
Anyway, so...
That sounds cool, though.
Let's just kind of leave it there. If you want to watch our reaction video, by the time this episode is out, it will be up on our YouTube channel. So go over to... The easiest way to find our YouTube... You can just go to YouTube and type in Tolkien Road, and it'll be the channel that comes up. Or you can go to... TolkienRoad.com/YouTube, and it'll redirect you to our YouTube channel where you can see that. So, you know, check out that video and check out the other videos we have on our channel. Subscribe, because, you know, I'm definitely working on doing more videos for 2021 and doing, you know, just doing more stuff that's kind of standalone from the podcast over there. And, but we, you know, you can also listen to the podcast, the latest episodes of the podcast over there. And, you know, just subscribe to our channel and be good stuff coming at you.
Yeah. So for sure.
All right. So, yeah, stick around to the end of the episode for, a little bit of correspondence. We are going to have actually a piece of correspondence right at the beginning of our discussion here that's relevant based on what we talked about last week. But our Tolkien quote of the week is from Mythopoeia.
Mm.
And you can go over and follow our Twitter account too if you're on Twitter. And, you know, as of late, I'm starting to post a quote, kind of a Tolkien thought or quote of the day over there on our Twitter account. And so this is the quote for this episode. The heart of man is not compound of lies, but draws some wisdom from the only wise and still recalls him. Right. Mm. And that's from Mythopoeia. So, which we've discussed a couple of times on the podcast, mm-hmm. and you can go back and find those episodes. But Mythopoeia is so quotable for me. And I just love this idea that, like, you know, that our hearts, that the things that come from our hearts are not lies. And this is specifically in reference to, you know, the work of like fantasy making, right? The work of, you know, of fantasizing, of creating these secondary worlds, you know, is what Tolkien is referring to. So, you know, it draws this wisdom from the only wise, and that only wise there is capitalized, right? To refer to God, right? Mm-hmm. To what we in Tolkienian terms, might call Iluvatar, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, the source of all, right? The ground of all being, the living God, right? So, so I just love that.
That's
love
really
that quote.
Good.
I mm-hmm. love that, this idea that, you know, the things that we devise, the things that we kind of dream up are not necessarily lies, but they draw wisdom from the deeper things of the universe, right?
You could even say that they're inspired.
Yes.
Right.
As he does elsewhere in the poem.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, good stuff. Cool.
All right, Greta, let's chat about the life of J.R.R. Tolkien, the last part.
Let's do it.
All right.
Yeah.
So I wanted to lead off our discussion of this topic with a note from David Bigwood, who is a longtime listener and a longtime fan of Tolkien. And he wrote a good note just kind of in response to some things we discussed last week on part three of this series. So I wanted to read that here. All right. So this is and he left this as a comment on the last episode. Dear Greta and John, first, thanks for the podcast. I look forward to each episode. A few comments. The Hobbit, or There and Back Again, is the full title of the book. Mm. Almost no one uses the subtitle, or There and Back Again, but it is there.
Okay.
Pull down your copy from the shelf or the nightstand, where mine is currently. Look at the title page, and you'll see it is there. Yeah, and I thought I thought that was the case.
I remember asking that question,
right?
Because I just don't remember seeing that subtitle on my copy, but I'm gonna go look now.
Yeah,
yeah.
He goes on. I know you have to be selective in what you include, but I think the revision of The Hobbit in connection with the writing of The Lord of the Rings is significant. Gollum is a very different character in the first edition. He shows Bilbo the way out and is very sorry he can't give him the ring. The scene where Bilbo leaps over Gollum is also absent. Mercy and faith are much less on display. For the next show, I guess you'll be covering the Ace paperback story. One of the better explanations of the whole copyright issue is in the September 1995 issue of Beyond Bree, The Great Copyright Controversy by Richard Blackwelder. I don't think you could get a copy before you record, but it is an interesting read. As a librarian, Marilyn isn't the only one. I feel I should recommend other readings. So I guess David is a librarian as well. I didn't realize that he was. Yeah,
okay.
That's really interesting, David.
It is, for sure.
It makes me feel really good that we have two very knowledgeable librarians that listen to this podcast.
Same. It makes me feel a little bit more legit, maybe.
I also, I need to pause here because I'm feeling a little braggy right now.
Maybe.
All right.
Is this a good
I'm just going to say,
trail?
I found out that somebody else listens to the podcast that I was just completely like blown away by. I can't say who it is. But it was really cool to hear that this person listened to the podcast. So anyway, for a long time, I accepted the biographic fallacy. This is back to David. So for a long time, I accepted the biographic fallacy reinforced by Tolkien, I guess. Modern researchers inform me that Beethoven cheated his publishers and abominably ill-treated his nephew. But I do not believe that has anything to do with his music. Tolkien, I'm sorry, that's a quote from the letters of J.R.R. Tolkien, right?
That so Tolkien
let me,
himself
let me,
wrote.
Let me do a better job with that right there.
Yeah, I'm
For
confused.
A long time, I accepted the biographic fallacy reinforced by Tolkien, I guess. Modern and this is quoting from Tolkien's letter, one of Tolkien's letters. Modern researchers inform me that Beethoven cheated his publishers and abominably ill-treated his nephew, but I do not believe that has anything to do with his music. All right, and so that's the quote from Tolkien, and that would be the biographic the biographic fallacy, right? Now, all right, let me go on and we'll come back to that. So aside from Carpenter, I avoided them. Occasionally, I dip into one of the library and found them not for me. The past 10 years or so has changed that a bit. I was late to reading Garth's excellent treatment of Tolkien's wartime experience, Tolkien and the Great War. I also found The Ring of Words covering his time on the OED enlightening. So my understanding of what David means by the biographic fallacy is the idea that I'm actually not sure if the biographic fallacy is the positive or the negative of this, but it has to do with the idea of like how much should a person's biography, an artist's biography, really have to do with appreciating their work, right? Mm-hmm. So in the reference, the thing that he references with Tolkien or that Tolkien says there about Beethoven, it's basically saying like, well, there's all these things about Beethoven being like a bad guy, right?
Yeah.
And in his personal life. And it's like, well, what does that really have to do with appreciating his music?
Right. Yeah.
So the same question could be asked, like, what does Tolkien's own biography have to do with understanding or appreciating his works, right? His actual works. Mm-hmm. I would probably lean more. And Tolkien was a big, Tolkien's view, it's like very little, right? Like, you know, at least what he wrote about. It doesn't really matter, you know, the thing that's important is the work that we have, right? That's what Tolkien would have advocated for. He would have been more on that side of the equation.
Yeah.
I'm actually more on the side of like, I think those things do matter. They're not maybe the most important thing in most cases, but a person's life story can help us better understand and better appreciate where like the, you know, different things about a story for sure. right?
Yeah, I think so. And I'm trying. I'm mulling over just kind of the difference. Like, I appreciate and understand why Tolkien made that, you know, that comparison between Beethoven and his music and himself and his works. But I feel like I'm trying to, like, music and writing, I feel like, is different. And I can't quite figure out how or why. But, I mean, not that Beethoven's personal life didn't inform his music, but maybe it's less obvious?
Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe because there's no words.
Well, in the case, yeah. Well, I see what you're saying there. There is a distinction to be made. And but you think about it, like, would Beethoven's music sound like it did if he had not lived in the time period he lived in and in the mm-hmm. place he lived in?
Right. No, right. That's true. That's
so
true.
I mean,
yeah.
He would, that music would not have come out of, you know, the 3rd century BC in India.
Right.
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 It would have been very, you know, he still might have been a musical genius, but the music would have been very, the music that he created would have been very different. Right.
Yeah.
So, you know, and just knowing about certain people can sometimes have to do with who, like, where they were, the context of their life. Right.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think at some point we do need to go into the whole, like, do a deep dive into the World War One topic that, mm-hmm. That I know, I think it's John Garth's book, which came out several years ago.
Yeah.
Goes really into, and we've had several different people recommend that to us. But yeah, I mean, I'm definitely more on the side. Like, I find this a really fascinating topic to go through his life story, knowing his works, like, mm-hmm. read through his letters and find out how all these personal interactions shaped him, how his friendship with C.S. Lewis, they kind of had this incredible, true friendship that was very mutually beneficial mm-hmm. for both of them mm-hmm. on a, mm-hmm. you know, on a, like, success, like a literary success level, right?
Yeah, they did. Yeah.
The
other thought I have ping-ponging in my brain is I wonder how much of Tolkien kind of not advocating for this position harkens back to just how much he spoke out against the idea of allegory.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if they're connected at all. Because when you say that, oh, yeah, his life story definitely informed his works, well, then it's easier to say, well, then this must represent this and this must represent that. And, you know, like, I feel like it's harder to disconnect,
mm-hmm.
Or easier to, anyway, I just wonder if that's kind of at the heart of why he spoke about it the way he did. I don't know.
Yeah. There was probably some sense in which he was reacting to perceived, errors, mm-hmm. right? Because there is an error, like, there, it's very easy to fall into different traps of reading things in a certain way and insisting that that's the only way to appreciate a work,
right?
Yeah. We obviously went through a little bit of this in our discussion of Lord of the Rings and religion, Middle Earth and religion. In some cases, a person's religion really has nothing much to do with their, you know, with their work, you know, with their work,
mm.
right? In other cases, it can have a whole lot to do. Right. And
yeah.
Tolkien is one of those cases. Right.
Mm-hmm.
It's not the only way to read it. Now, we would be in great error if we had been like, you have to, you know, you have to have this appreciation and you have
right.
to have this perspective in order to understand it.
Right.
And yeah, he was very anti that kind of way of reading his works. Like, you know, well, the lens that you have to have in order to appreciate my book is that you have to understand that orcs mm-hmm. are really communists.
Right.
Right. Like,
right.
You know, that's not how he was. He repudiated that. But what I find really interesting that popped into my head is this. The question of the biographic fallacy that Tolkien was against this idea that, well, I have to appreciate, you know, Tolkien or Beethoven's life in order to appreciate him. Tolkien's final word on his life in the life of his wife basically was a thumbs up to the, I guess you could say, to the biographical fallacy, right? To the biographic fallacy, right? Because what was the epitaph, right?
The epitaph.
Beren
you're
and
right.
Luthien, right?
You're absolutely right.
The stories
right.
he wrote, right? He named for, you know, the final word on his life and the life of Edith was Beren and Luthien, right?
Good point.
So
yeah,
I find that a little bit ironic,
yeah.
given, you know, that he was against that sort of, you know, that sort of way. It's also very beautiful, but
yeah.
Anyway, I very much am a fan of the idea that like understanding a person's life can really help to illuminate their works greatly. Mm. I like reading about the stories of like music, like records I like, right? Mm-hmm. Like how do they come to be, right? I find that kind of stuff fascinating.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So anyway.
I agree.
I'll have to check out the Ring of Words too. I'm interested to know more about his time on the OED. Finally, David's letter. As for comparisons between Alice and the Hobbits, there are several. Both were written by Oxford professors of difficult subjects.
Hmm,
there you go.
Okay.
Both can be enjoyed by children and adults. Both are works of imagination. As for the other works Lewis mentions, The Wind in the Willows is still a great read. Mm-hmm. Love The Wind in the Willows.
That's so good.
One of my all-time favorites. The chapter where they see Pan on the island is as good a story as a story can get, and a surprise in a book filled with homey comforts and hijinks. Oh my gosh, like David, that is like the Pan scene. I remember the first time I read that, it's still one of the most amazing like literary experiences I've ever had. Like when you get these little critters, you know, acting like, you know, like kind of English countryside gentlemen, and then it's like this god appears to them. And it's just like, whoa, what is happening? It was amazing. Yeah, it truly is. And then he goes on to say, Flatland is interesting, but maybe a way to make geometry more palatable. Fantasties, I think that's how you say that, doesn't work for me.
I looked up that after we recorded last week, and it's by George MacDonald, I think, who also wrote The Princess and the Goblin.
I see.
So that put it in a little bit more context for me.
Yeah, George MacDonald is I know George MacDonald was influential upon both Tolkien and Lewis, and I think the rest of the Inklings, obviously, honestly. So,
yeah.
Good stuff.
Absolutely.
Well, thank you, David, and thank you for a letter that gave us a lot to talk about, just kind of on the heels of the last episode.
Mm-hmm.
And
answered a couple of questions I had as well.
Definitely answered a couple of questions. Yeah. I do also, a couple of people wrote in about this. We got a note from both David of Pints with Jack and from Bethany, longtime patron Bethany E, and the Latin phrase in C.S. Lewis's letter, right? So when he wrote his Lord of the Rings review after reading the draft of it in 1949, the Latin phrase was ubi plura nitent in carmine non ego paucis offendo maculis. And it is a phrase, according to Bethany, it is a phrase attributed to Horace, and it means, where many beauties shine in a poem, I will not be offended by a few blemishes.
Mm. Yeah. Pretty much sums up Lewis's review pretty
well.
Absolutely,
yeah. Yeah. Well, that's that's in general how I feel about everything Tolkien writes, right? It's like, you know, the beauty of it all is so overwhelmingly great that you can tell me about this little issue right here or this little issue right here.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just like, I don't care.
Yeah.
All right. So that's David's letter. And that I feel like that's a good jumping off point into this final part of Tolkien's life. So on the last episode, we left off with Tolkien having completed the draft of The Lord of the Rings in 1949, which was the culmination of 12 years of labor. But still, Lord of the Rings had a few years to go before it was unleashed upon the world. So, 1949, he finishes the draft, but the book doesn't actually come out until 1954, right? Mm. So, you know, there's still 5 years worth of time. So what happened in that time? Well, you know, obviously Lord of the Rings is a huge work, right? So there was a lot of editing. I don't even think that he had officially a publisher at this point. Like, you know, this is 12 years after he had started writing the sequel to The Hobbit. So, you know, were Allen and Unwin even interested in publishing this book? I mean, was Tolkien maybe like kind of a forgotten name at this point? You know, it's like one hit wonder, right? Now, he had published some minor works in that period of time, some short stories and some other works like that in the interim. Yeah. But he had not delivered on that, you know, the sequel, right, to The Hobbit. So, but here he is, 1949. And at this point, as Tolkien finishes, he in fact wanted a new publisher. So I'm going to read from.
He did not want to go back.
At this point, no. Okay. Right. So I'm going to read a little bit about this from Carpenter again. Going to use Carpenter's biography quite a bit on this episode. His excellent biography. So this is on page 211. It had taken 12 years to write The Lord of the Rings. By the time that he had finished it, Tolkien was not far from his 60th birthday. Now, of course, he wanted to see the huge book in print, but he was not sure that he wanted Allen and Unwin to publish it, even though he had discussed it with them while it was being written, and they had encouraged him and shown approval of the manuscript, for he believed that he had now found someone who would publish it together with the Silmarillion. Over the years, he had become angry with Allen and Unwin for rejecting the Silmarillion in 1937, though in truth, they had not really rejected it at all. Stanley Unwin had merely said that it was not suitable as a sequel to The Hobbit, and Tolkien had come to believe that it was a case of once rejected, always rejected, which was a pity, he thought, because he wanted to publish The Silmarillion. It was possible to say that The Lord of the Rings stood up as an independent story, but since it included obscure references to the earlier mythology, it would be much better if the two books could be published together. But most of all, he wanted to find an audience for the earlier book, and this seemed the ideal, perhaps the only opportunity. So when Milton Waldman from the publishing house of Collins showed an interest in publishing both works, Tolkien was strongly inclined to abandon Allen and Unwin and join forces with him. Waldman, a Catholic, had been introduced to Tolkien by Gervais Mathieu, a scholar and Dominican priest who often attended meetings of the Inklings. When Waldman learned that Tolkien had completed a lengthy sequel to that very successful book, The Hobbit, he expressed interest, and late in 1949, Tolkien sent him a bulky manuscript. But it was not The Lord of the Rings. It was The Silmarillion. The earlier mythological work, begun in 1917 as The Book of Lost Tales, was still incomplete, but Tolkien had begun work on it again while he was finishing The Lord of the Rings, and it was in a sufficiently ordered state for Waldman to read it. It was like nothing else Waldman had ever seen, a strange, archaically worded tale of elves, evil powers, and heroism. Some of it was typed, but much was in finely lettered manuscript. Waldman told Tolkien that he thought it was remarkable, and he said that he wanted to publish it, providing Tolkien could finish it. Tolkien was delighted. Waldman had passed the first test. He had provisionally accepted The Silmarillion. He was invited down to Oxford by Tolkien and was handed the manuscript of The Lord of the Rings. He took it on holiday and began to read it. By the beginning of January 1950, he had almost finished it, and again he told Tolkien that he was delighted. "It is a real work of creation," he wrote, although he added that the length of the book worried him. But he was very hopeful that Collins would be able to put it into print. So that's where the, you know, and we've referred oftentimes to the Waldman letter on on this episode, and, you know, that's where, that's kind of who this fellow Waldman is, right? Mm-hmm. It was somebody that Tolkien was looking at possibly being a publisher, not only for The Lord of the Rings, but for The Silmarillion as well. So there was a lot of drama over the next 2 years as Tolkien tried unsuccessfully to get both Unwin and Collins to publish Lord of the Rings and The Silmarillion.
So he wanted it as one volume?
I don't know if he... Did it say he wanted it as one
volume? No, but I mean, I guess I kind of jumped to that conclusion because of the way it was described, but...
I think it would, the idea was publish them both, right? Like publish them as separate works, right?
But at the same time.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, or around the same time, right? Kind of as a, just as a package deal in terms of, like, if you're going to publish Lord of the Rings, the AKA The New Hobbit, then I want you to publish The Silmarillion as well.
That makes sense.
Is the idea.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's where, you know, that's kind of who this fellow Waldman is. So, there's a lot of drama over the next 2 years, and eventually it all comes back to Unwin, right? So
Waldman didn't follow through or changed his mind or what?
Well, let me read this and then we'll discuss that.
Okay.
On 10 November 1952, Rainer Unwin, who of course Rainer was the boy who wrote the review of The Hobbit for his father, right? Mm-hmm. Rainer Unwin, and now he's grown up, wrote to Tolkien to say that the firm would like to publish The Lord of the Rings under a profit sharing agreement. This meant that Tolkien would not a picture in my mind. A little kid writing back to Tolkien and being like, "Love this book, especially the part about hobbits and dragons. Can we discuss some kind of a profit sharing agreement?" So yes, Rainer Unwin now grown up and part of the family business. This meant that Tolkien would not receive conventional royalty payments on a percentage basis. Instead, he would be paid half profits. That is, he would receive nothing until the sales of the book had been sufficient to cover its costs. But thenceforward, he would share equally with the publisher and any profits that might accrue. This method, which had once been common practice but was by this time little used by other firms, was still favored by Sir Stanley Unwin for all potentially uneconomical books. It helped to keep down the price of such books, since there was no need to include an additional sum in the costing to cover the author's royalties. On the other hand, if the book sold unexpectedly well, the author would benefit more substantially than under a royalty agreement. Not that Allen and Unwin expected The Lord of the Rings to sell more than a few thousand copies, for it was bulky, unconventional, and did not appeal to any one market, being neither a children's book nor an adult novel. And I kind of skipped over the whole, a lot of the controversy because I'm trying not to get too bogged down in like some of the fine points. I just find it interesting that there was like, why did it take from the time the manuscript was completed in 1949 all the way till 1954 for the book to see the light of the day, mm-hmm. of day, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's because there was kind of this, Tolkien wanted to find a publisher for both works, for both The Silmarillion and The Lord of the Rings. And there was this time where he flirted with having another publisher taken on board, but he ultimately came back to Unwin and had them publish Lord of the Rings. And so Fellowship was published in mid-1954, with The Two Towers following a few months later and The Return of the King in late 1955.
Okay.
So the solution to this being a really long book was to divide it up into three parts.
Mm-hmm.
And honestly, that might have helped sales some, right?
Because, yeah, I was going to say, that's a good marketing approach.
Absolutely, right? Yeah. And so, we know there's cliffhangers, right?
Mm-hmm.
At the end mm-hmm. of both. So it's an interesting, editorial decision back in the early 50s. We think of that as no dud, right?
Right. Nowadays. I was going to say, it's much more common now.
But it was probably an editorial decision that led to, contributed in some significant part to the success of The Lord of the Rings, right?
Yes.
So,
yeah. I had to.
So initial success is modest. 3,500 copies of Fellowship of the Ring were initially ordered, and then less for The Two Towers and Return of the King on their first printings.
Hmm.
But this quickly proved to be too little, and reprints were ordered.
Okay.
And then once all three volumes had been published, the critics were able to weigh in on the entire work. And so, again, reading some of the, what Carpenter has to say about this. Now that all three volumes had appeared, the critics were able to make a full assessment of The Lord of the Rings. C.S. Lewis paid another tribute in Time and Tide. The book is too original and too opulent for any final judgment on a first reading. But we know at once that it has done things to us. We are not quite the same men.
Hmm.
A new voice was added to the chorus of praise when Bernard Levin wrote in Truth that he believed it to be one of the most remarkable works of literature in our or any time. It is comforting in this troubled day to be once more assured that the meek shall inherit the earth. But there were further criticisms of the style. John Metcalf wrote in the Sunday Times, "Far too often Mr. Tolkien strides away into a kind of brewer's biblical, enwreathed with inversions, encrusted with archaisms." And Edwin Muir returned to the attack in a review in The Observer headed A Boy's World. "The astonishing thing," he wrote, "is that all of the characters are boys masquerading as adult heroes. The hobbits, or halflings, are ordinary boys. The fully human heroes have reached the fifth form. But hardly one of them knows anything about women, except by hearsay. Even the elves and the dwarves and the ents are boys, irretrievably, and will never come to puberty." Interesting criticism.
Hmm.
And then Tolkien writes, "Blast Edwin Muir and his delayed adolescence," snorted Tolkien. "He's old enough to know better. If he had an MA, I should nominate him for the professor of poetry. Sweet revenge."
Oh, boom. Someone
so
just
Tolkien,
got burned.
Tolkien,
if he had an MA, which he clearly does not.
So Tolkien had his own response for Edmund Weir. By now, opinions were firmly polarized. The book had acquired its champions and its enemies, and as W.A. Auden wrote, "Nobody seems to have a moderate opinion. Either, like myself, people find it a masterpiece of its genre, or they cannot abide it." And this was how it was to remain for the rest of Tolkien's life. Extreme praise from one faction, total contempt from the other. On the whole, Tolkien himself did not mind this very much. Indeed, it amused him. He wrote of it, "The Lord of the Rings is one of those things. If you like, you do. If you don't, then you boo."
Who wrote that?
Tolkien.
Tolkien. Then you boo.
Right.
That's funny.
Yeah, so...
That's interesting.
So, a very mixed reaction to it. But the interesting thing is that it was a very polarized reaction, right? And that's important, mm-hmm. I think, right? This was not a work where people came to it and they're like, it was okay. Right?
You either loved it or you hated it.
It was either like, this is maybe one of the greatest things I've ever read. Mm-hmm. Or people were saying, oh, you know, it's like they're all boys and this is children's stuff and blah, 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 blah.
And there's no women. Right. And the men will never come to puberty.
Right.
I don't even know what that means.
I don't even know what that means either. So,
that is crazy, though. I mean, it's just, it's funny to me that people would have, you know, that some readers had that reaction. Although I will say, I think a book with polarizing reviews mm-hmm. is the mark of a really good book.
Yeah, it probably is.
I think it is.
I think any writer would ultimately want that any book he writes is going to be, because I can think of things that just like everybody loves, mm-hmm. right? So that's probably the ideal. But at the very least, for the people who love what you do, you want them to really love it, right?
You do. And I feel like if I were to ever write a book, I would not want someone to finish it and be like, eh. Like, I would rather them be like, this is amazing, the best thing I ever read, or right. this was terrible and yeah. I'm going to burn it.
Well, it's kind of like when we listened to that clip from The Office Ladies, you know, on a couple episodes ago,
mm-hmm.
where Jenna Fischer basically, it was funny because she was just tripping over everything. And she's talked about Lord of the Rings a couple of times on the podcast and just been like, it's just not something I can even like know how to get into. Like, mm-hmm. I just don't even know how. And I think there are genuinely people out there who yeah. just like, they don't, like, it just doesn't work for them for
right.
whatever reason.
Mm-hmm.
And so mm-hmm. I can imagine if Edwin Weir was a person like that, who, you know, was just not into fantasy, or anything of that genre, then having to sit down and read that whole book would be torture for him. Right?
Yes. Yeah. Like, I can see that.
And I mean, we have family members. I mean, none of our family listens to this podcast, right?
Yeah. I don't think many of our friends do either.
I've had, and that's fine. Like,
totally.
a few people that we know do listen to it, but it's kind of like, you know, it's kind of like John and Greta isn't kind of like really John's nerd thing, right? For a lot of them. And, you know, like, I have family members who are very much, very literary people, very into reading, you know, read mm-hmm. a lot. And they've told me like, I think it's great that y'all do a podcast, but I'm sorry, I'm just not into the like Tolkien stuff, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And mm-hmm. so.
And that's fair.
It's
I
fair.
Mean, to each his own,
not,
to each his own.
Not everybody has to be, but I feel like it's always cool when you hear about somebody that finally gives it a chance. And then they're like, this wasn't what I thought it was. This is like, yeah, it's got like the Dungeons and Dragons stuff in it, but there's so much more to it, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
It's
yeah.
You know, it's of a higher level. It's of a higher order
yeah.
than
yeah.
typical works of that genre,
right? But it's not for everyone. And I think what I was trying to say about the polarizing reviews is you know, it's kind of like when you say the absence of, or the opposite of love is not hate,
mm-hmm.
it's indifference, right?
Yeah.
So if you have someone that hates your book, like, there's still, at the root of it, there's some kind of emotion
mm-hmm.
there, right? So I think that's why if I were Tolkien, I would be happy with polarizing reviews, because that means that it's eliciting some kind of emotional reaction.
Right, polarizing reviews rather than, you know, just
rather than
lukewarm.
Just like lukewarm,
right.
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly. Rather than just indifference and eh,
mm-hmm.
you know. I mean, of course, I would hope that more people loved it than hated it, but you know, I think it's not a bad thing to have a book that polarizes people.
I agree.
Good. Okay.
So sales continued to climb steadily over the next few years. We're still, you know, we're still in the 50s here, late 50s at this point. As well as translations in other languages. So the book started to be translated into other languages. And of course that helps with success. I have one particular person that I knew growing up, not a writer, but of a different sort of artist growing up in Kentucky, found his first success, in the Netherlands, in Belgium and the Netherlands of all places before he really started to find success back here at home in the States. So it's funny how that can work sometimes.
It is. I know.
The old joke is the rock bands that are big in Japan, right? Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Anyway, so translations begin to appear in other languages. So that's another mark of rising success. And then in 1957, the first proposal for the film rights appeared.
Mm.
So again, reading from Carpenter. You want to read this? So this little part marked in red there.
Right. By this time, it was clear that The Lord of the Rings was something of an international hot property. Stanley Unwin warned Tolkien that offers would soon be forthcoming for the film rights, and the two men agreed upon their policy, either a respectable treatment of the book or else a good deal of money. As Sir Stanley put it, the choice was between cash or kudos. The first overtures from the film world came at the end of 1957 when Tolkien was approached by three American businessmen who showed him drawings for a proposed animated motion picture of The Lord of the Rings. These gentlemen, who are Mr. Forrest J. Ackerman, Mr. Morton Grady Zimmerman, and Mr. Al Brodax, also delivered to him a scenario or storyline for the proposed film. Reading this, Tolkien discovered that it did not exactly treat the book with respect. A number of names were consistently misspelt. For example, Boromir was rendered Boromor. Virtually all walking was dispensed within the story, and the company of the ring were transported everywhere on the backs of eagles, and the elvish whey bread, lembas, was described as a food concentrate. There did not seem to be much prospect of kudos in this, and as there was not much cash either, negotiations were not continued, but it was an indication of things to come. In the meanwhile, Tolkien's income from his books remained high. "I am afraid," he said, "I cannot help feeling there is a lot to be said for the grosser forms of literary success, as a sneering critic recently called it."
There you go. So it's funny, of course, to read about these, like, you know, American businessmen, movie producers coming up to Tolkien and being just with all these errors in the story.
Mm-hmm.
And I, you know, having watched, like, you know, Mad Men and that kind of thing, you can just kind of like picture, you know, like,
oh, the kind of, like, men that were
the American businessmen, and like this time
and
like
dealing.
yeah hey there, Tolkien got a deal for you, you know, like love that Lord of the Rings book you put out there.
Are they from Brooklyn or
that's my American businessman of the 1950s
gotcha
kind of voice.
Did
that not register?
No offense to anybody from Brooklyn that's listening. I was especially tickled by the fact that they call lembas food concentrate.
I love that they like Boromir is Boromor, and yeah, and they're just like, enough with this walking stuff. Let's just have everybody fly on eagles everywhere.
Because walking is boring.
I am just so thankful that Tolkien was not like, ooh, chance to cash in, right? Mm-hmm. You know, that he was like, no. And probably like, hell no.
Right? Yeah.
Get out.
Yeah. Just don't even... Yeah. Don't let the door hit you on the way out.
Yeah. We can be very thankful that Tolkien was not agreeable to any of these requests to do film,
to
do film.
We have seen an animated version of The Hobbit.
The Hobbit, but it didn't come out until after Tolkien's death.
And this is Lord of the Rings we're talking about.
Yeah, and I think I can't remember the history of the film rights. I think we've talked about it on past episodes. But anyway, I just thought that was a funny little picture from Tolkien's life of his first experience with people coming to him being like, I think this will make a great movie, right? I've also read that there was discussion at one point about the Beatles doing Lord of the Rings, but that wouldn't have come until much later, right? Until like the late 60s.
Like the Beatles
I don't know that Tolkien was ever asked about it, but like the Beatles would be like the four hobbits, right? Yeah. So...
would they like...
which again, so glad that didn't happen. That would have been terrible.
I don't know. Part of me kind of wanted, like, would like to hear the Beatles, like, music. Like what they would do with, like, with the music that, or the, you know, the songs that Tolkien wrote. Oh, I'm stopping now.
Are you trying to get fired?
No. I don't know, maybe. Am I? It's one of those morbid curiosity things, I guess.
Morbid curiosity. Okay, I can handle morbid curiosity. It's morbid curiosity for me, like, you know, like going back and watching like the, what was it? Was it The Hobbit? The very first animated Hobbit that we talked a little bit about on one of our past episodes, the one that was done in the 60s to like hang on to the film rights or something like that.
Mm.
But it's not the animated Hobbit everybody knows, but it's a really like ridiculous, poorly done, like 5 minute long movie. So, anyway, yeah, Morbid Curiosity. File the Beatles, Lord of the Rings under Morbid Curiosity.
The Lord of the Rings, according to the Beatles.
Yes.
I don't know. Maybe on Broadway. Yeah. All right, moving on.
There is a Broadway version of Lord of the Rings.
With the Beatles?
Not with the Beatles.
Oh.
Yeah.
Well, then I'm not interested.
Okay. Well, all right. Cool. Neither am I, so. Okay. All right.
We agree.
Yeah, so so we got the film rights out of the way. And then, you know, really the next big step in, I guess you'd call it like the inflection point in Tolkien's success and the Lord of the Rings success comes in the 60s. In 1965, in order to prevent an American publisher from publishing a perhaps technically legal, though unauthorized version of The Lord of the Rings, Tolkien issued some revisions to Lord of the Rings, and The Hobbit was republished in authorized form. However, the unauthorized version of it had been published as well, and it was also selling very well. So eventually, this led to an American business controversy, which perhaps solidified Tolkien's ongoing popularity.
I'm sorry, real quick.
Yeah.
Someone else published the book without his permission? Is that what you're saying?
Right. So, for whatever reason, there was a leak. There was kind of a legal loophole that would allow, at some point, another American publisher that was not the one that Tolkien had authorized to publish the book, and they took advantage of it, right?
Interesting.
And so that's why Tolkien got so busy doing these, you know, proposed revisions to The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings in the 60s, right? Which we talked about his revisions for The Hobbit that never really came to fruition, but we did a couple of episodes on The Hobbit, The Lost Chapters, right? And that's part of this little why those things exist.
So is this what David mentioned in his note about
the controversy.
Ace paperback
right.
controversy? Okay.
Yeah. So this is Ace was the unauthorized publisher, and then Ballantine was the authorized publisher. So this comes from Carpenter, page 231. Meanwhile, the authorized paperback publishers, Ballantine Books, had decided that they could not wait any longer. In order to get at least one Tolkien book into the shops, they published The Hobbit in the original text without waiting for Tolkien's revisions, which they planned to include in a later edition. They sent him a copy, and he was astonished by the picture on the cover. Ace Books, for all their moral piracy, had employed a cover artist who knew something about the story, but Ballantine's cover picture seemed to have no relevance whatever to The Hobbit, for it showed a hill, two emus, and a curious tree bearing bulbous fruit.
Emus.
Tolkien exploded. What has it got to do with the story? Where is this place? Why emus? And what is the thing in the foreground with pink bulbs? When the reply came that the artist hadn't time to read the book and that the object with pink bulbs was meant to suggest a Christmas tree, Tolkien could only answer, "I begin to feel that I am shut up in a madhouse." Late in 1965, the authorized paperback of The Lord of the Rings was published in America in 3 volumes, with Tolkien's revisions incorporated, and with the emus and the Christmas tree on the cover of the first volume, though this picture was later removed and one of Tolkien's own drawings was substituted. 2 more of his pictures were used for the second and third volumes. Each copy carried a message from Tolkien. This paperback edition and no other has been published with my consent and cooperation. Those who approve of courtesy, at least, to living authors will purchase it and no other. But this did not immediately produce the desired result. The Ballantine edition, because it paid a royalty, cost 20 cents per volume more than the Ace edition, and the American student buyers did not at first show a preference for it. Clearly, something more would have to be done. Curiously, Tolkien himself played a prominent and efficient part in the campaign that now began. Curiously, because he was no businessman, and ironically, because the unbusinesslike habits of his recent years were now turned to good advantage. He had been accustomed to waste many hours that ought to have been spent on completing works for publication by writing innumerable replies to fan letters, but this did mean that he had already built up an affectionate following of many dozens of enthusiastic correspondents, especially in America, and they were now only too glad to spring to his defense. On his own initiative, he began to include a note in all his replies to American readers, informing them that the Ace edition was unauthorized, and asking them to tell their friends. This soon had a remarkable effect. American readers not only began to refuse to buy the Ace edition, but demanded, often in forcible terms, that booksellers remove it from their shelves. A fan club, the Tolkien Society of America, which had recently been formed, now joined in the battle. By the end of the year, the sales of Ace copies began to fall sharply, and when the cause was taken up by the Science Fiction Writers of America, an influential body that now applied considerable pressure to Ace, the result was that Ace wrote to Tolkien offering to pay him a royalty for every copy they had sold, and stating that they would not reprint after their present stocks had been exhausted. So a treaty was signed, and the war over Middle-earth, as one journalist had dubbed it, came to an end. But the most important consequence was yet to come. The dispute had attracted considerable publicity, and as a result, Tolkien's name and the titles of his books were now very widely known in America. Approximately 100,000 copies of the Ace edition of The Lord of the Rings had been sold during 1965 alone. But this figure was soon passed by the authorized paperback, which quickly reached the 1 million mark. Ace had unwittingly done a service to Tolkien, for they had helped to lift his book from the respectable hardcover status in which it had languished for some years, and had put it at the top of the popular bestsellers. And by now, a campus cult had begun. So,
wow, that's intense.
Yeah, but it's cool. You know, it's just it's interesting how that little controversy really served to catapult Lord of the Rings, right?
Yeah.
I mean, 1965. The Ace Unauthorized Edition sold 100,000 copies, which is a lot, you know, for any book. And, you know, it wasn't even, this is 11 years after it had been published originally, right?
Yeah.
I mean.
Yeah, you're right.
And then for the Ballantine, the authorized version, to sell a million copies that year, you're just like, wow, this thing is really, I mean, it's 10 years old at this point. Right?
Yeah.
So maybe, and again, I'm not really interested in getting into the technicalities right now, but maybe the issue was that Ace, since no one had the rights to the paperback, I guess, in America, maybe that was what it was, or there was a loophole, again, some kind of technicality where Ace was like, well, then if no one has the rights, then we'll do it, right, to the paperback as opposed to the hardcover. So.
And that could very much, like, just that spike in sales could be very much due to the fact that it was a paperback.
Yeah.
I mean, I'll be honest, I don't like reading hardcover books.
Yeah.
they're heavier to travel with,
right.
And they're just more bulky. They look prettier on a bookshelf, but their paperbacks are way easier to read.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, you can, and you can kind of picture, like, the college student of that time, like, kind of walking around with whatever book they're reading in, like, their back pocket, right? You know,
exactly.
And, like, you know,
yes.
They're not going to be walking around with a big hardback cover in their back pocket.
No.
It's logistically Mm-mm. impossible.
Absolutely.
They're walking around with a paperback copy of something in their back
and
pocket.
And plus, college students are poor, and hardbacks are expensive. So, I mean, I feel like paperbacks, why didn't you... I'm sorry, I'll get off. I'm not even going to start with my soapbox about hardbacks.
Well, I love, too, that basically the reason Tolkien was able to triumph in this was because he had been so willing to correspond with his fan mail, right?
Mm-hmm.
That he had, like, mm-hmm. that the people that he had built up, like, this, like, fan base that was, like, very, very devoted to
him. I was
going to
say devoted, yeah.
Right?
Yep.
And because he took the time to correspond, right?
Right.
Now, as fans, we kind of look back now and we may be like, well, I wish he'd actually spent that time writing more, giving us more stories maybe about Middle Earth, but, you know, but... It is what it is, right?
Right.
And it's a very Tolkienian thing that like, it was more important to him to, like, write back and, like, correct people's misconceptions in these stories.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then that ultimately, like, just that little touch of, like, human respect that success, the rising success of his stories had not robbed him of, you know, his, like, love for kind of, like just the common man and discussing literature and all this kind of stuff, right? It's like, you know, don't forget me when you're famous, right?
Mm. Forget the little people.
Don't forget the little people.
Yeah.
And Tolkien was like, he lived that, right? He was all about the little people.
Right. The little people were the heroes in his stories.
And And he didn't, he absolutely didn't forget them. He always, mm-hmm. he always was a little person at heart, really, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah. Yeah. No, you're absolutely right. And, you know, I love that, you know, I love that all those fans kind of rushed to his aid and, you know, like really, you know, it's, they just fought that battle for him, mm-hmm. which I think is really cool. But it's also interesting to me that Ace is not like, they weren't a super bad guy. They offered to pay him.
Well, after they got some pressure, they did. Now, you know,
yeah,
I wouldn't call that
true.
I'd still call that kind of, you know,
it's a little underhanded, I guess, but
I mean, I didn't do a super deep dive on this topic, so I don't know all of the details of the controversy.
Mm-hmm.
But it's pretty rotten when, you know, when the writer's not getting paid for something, you know, they're still living. Their book just came out 10 years ago and you're like, well, I guess we'll publish this. There's nothing, the law says we can't. Like,
mm-hmm.
People should just be better than that. You know?
Yeah, I agree. I do, at the very deep down, but I'll be honest. I mean, I would have been all about a cheap paperback version as a college student.
Well, I think it's different for you as an individual, like not knowing, especially back then,
not knowing the league. Like,
you're just like, yeah, I've heard this is a good book, I'm going to read this, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's different.
Mm-hmm.
And from that perspective, it's like the whole thing about when Napster first came
out. I was just thinking about Napster.
Right?
I was like, is this the book version of Napster? Then, maybe it is.
And then, you know, they started suing the, like the kids who were just like using Napster to download and discover music.
Right.
You know?
Right.
It's like,
we didn't know any better.
That's pretty messed up.
What?
Yeah. Well, you might have known better. You know,
I didn't know better. I'll be honest. I really didn't.
Kind of knew better, but you're still like, this is just too cool to be like, I can like literally listen
like
to anything
is,
I want to.
Yes. It was the best.
Yeah.
But yeah. But then when you think about the ramifications of it, yeah, it's pretty low.
Yeah. Anyway. So, but for a publisher to do this is like for the business when they know how the publishing industry works. I mean, that's pretty messed up. So
mm-hmm.
They probably avoided further controversy and maybe some really bad hits to their business by doing that finally, by paying him royalties. So
mm-hmm.
it was, you know, for me, it seems like more of a CYA measure than a, you know, like an act of true
yeah.
contrition.
Yeah, I, you're probably right about that, actually. So. Yeah.
And so the cult, it by this time, it's spreading everywhere, late 60s. And by 1968, Carpenter estimates that 3 million copies had been sold worldwide.
Wow.
So,
wow.
It has really taken off at that point.
Beyond anyone's expectations, it sounds like. Yeah.
Yeah. And here, Tolkien is 70 years old in 1968, right?
Wow.
So,
I'm glad he got to see that.
I am too.
That's
you know,
success.
Like to know.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and I think he was already making a good amount of money from it even before that.
Yes.
But
yes.
You know, he's rolling in it by this time, right? So, all right, so retirement and the Silmarillion. Tolkien retired from his academic career a few years after the publication of Lord of the Rings. His assessment of the state of the scholarly world was, according to Carpenter, rather pessimistic. So Carpenter 239 says this to say about his valedictory address, so is kind of his retirement address from there to there.
In his valedictory address given to a packed audience in Merton College Hall at the end of his final summer term, Tolkien touched on some of the changes that were taking place in Oxford. He directed some barbed remarks towards the increasing emphasis on postgraduate research, which he described as the degeneration of real curiosity and enthusiasm into a planned economy under which so much research time is stuffed into more or less standard skins and turned out in sausages of a size and shape approved by our own little printed cookery book.
I just have to say that, and not that I'm an expert on modern academia, I've spent some time there. I think that's pretty prophetic.
I thought you were going to say that.
That's all I'm going to say. You know, I virtual high five from beyond the grave for Tolkien for that one. So, upon his retirement in 1959, Tolkien was able to turn his attention entirely to Middle Earth. Of course, given his tendencies for perfectionism and procrastination, nothing went so smoothly. Though he continued to work on the Silmarillion as well as revisions to all of his works, the Silmarillion would not be published until 4 years after his death in 1977. And most of us know by now that there were so many other stories that were never fully completed. So death and legacy, and I want to cover, you know, the deaths of a couple of important people that preceded him. Obviously, C.S. Lewis, who we refer to, you know, other than Edith, there is like maybe no more present person in the story of Tolkien's life and the legend of Tolkien than C.S. Lewis, right? The effect they had on one another, as friends, and you know, is kind of literary, like reviewing each other's work and making suggestions and this kind of thing. Huge, huge impact on one another. So from C.S. Lewis, of course, died on November 22nd, 1963, which was, do you know what date that is, Greta?
November 22nd.
Little quiz for Greta while I pull up my letter.
Yeah, I was going to say, I'm thinking, I know it's not Thanksgiving because that date changes
1963.
Every year. 1963. Oh, JFK's assassination.
Yep. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Wow, wow. Okay.
Yeah, C.S. Lewis died on the same day that JFK was assassinated. So,
wow. Interesting.
Talk about a day to die as a famous person. Like,
right?
It's like kind of going to get glossed over a little bit, right? You know, by the news on that
yeah,
one.
Yeah, he probably didn't get as good what was due. Anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it's not that
not
matters
that it was
that
due,
much
but
to somebody like C.S. Lewis, but he's gotten plenty of due after in his lifetime and afterwards.
For sure.
So Tolkien wrote a letter to Priscilla, his youngest child, his daughter, written 4 days after the death of C.S. Lewis on 26 November 1963. "Dearest, thank you so much for your letter. So far, I have felt the normal feelings of a man of my age, like an old tree that is losing all its leaves one by one. This feels like an axe blow near the roots. Very sad that we should have been so separated in the last years, but our time of close communion endured in memory for both of us. I had a mass said this morning and was there and served, and Havard and Dundas Grant were present. The funeral at Holy Trinity, the Headington Quarry Church, which Jack attended, was quiet and attended only by intimates and some Magdalen people, including the president. Austin Farrer read the lesson. The grave is under a larch in the corner of the churchyard. Douglas Gresham was the only family mourner. Warney was not present, alas. I saw Owen Barfield, George Sayer, and John Lawler, a good mark to him, among others. Christopher came with us. There will be an official memorial service in There will be an official memorial service in Maudlin on Saturday at 2:15 p.m. It was very sweet of you, my dearest, to write. God bless you, Daddy." And then he wrote another letter to Michael just a little while later. "I'm sorry that I have not answered your letter sooner, but Jack Lewis's death on the 22nd has preoccupied me. It is also involving me in some correspondence, as many people still regard me as one of his intimates. Alas, that ceased to be some 10 years ago. We were separated first by the sudden apparition of Charles Williams and then by his marriage, of which he never even told me. I learned of it long after the event. But we owed each a great debt to the other, and that tie with the deep affection that it begot remains. He was a great man of whom the cold-blooded official obituaries only scraped the surface in places with injustice. How little truth there may be in literary appraisals, one may learn from them, since they were written while he was still alive. Lewis only met Williams in 1939, and Williams died early in 1945. The space travel trilogy ascribed to the influence of Williams was basically foreign to Williams' kind of imagination. It was planned years before when we decided to divide. He was to do space travel and I time travel. My book was never finished, but some of it, the Numenorean Atlantis theme, got into my trilogy eventually. Publication dates are not a good guide. Perelandra is dated 1943 but does not belong to that period. Williams' influence actually only appeared with his death. That hideous strength, the end of the trilogy, which, good though it is in itself, I think spoiled it. Also, I was wryly amused to be told, from the Daily Telegraph, that Lewis himself was never very fond of the Screwtape Letters. His bestseller, 250,000 copies. He dedicated it to me. I wondered why. Now I know, says they." So, I'm not really sure what that means there at the very end, but
yeah.
I feel like Tolkien's winking when he says that, so... I don't quite follow, but anyway, I thought that was just really interesting how he's been preoccupied with the death of Lewis.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like they kind of lost touch though.
Oh, they did. They did very much.
Last 10 years. He wasn't even at his wedding. I mean, that's kind of huge.
Yeah. Well, that,
I mean, I know it happens. Like, life happens. But
well, there was also Tolkien, without getting too far into it right now, I mean, so Lewis married a divorcee.
Oh, that's right.
And,
that's right. I remember now.
You
yeah.
know, Tolkien did not really approve.
Right.
Right. So, right.
Yeah. Okay.
So anyway, that's a whole other issue for some other time if we ever even get to that.
I'd forgotten that piece.
But that's
okay.
there was kind of a falling out, the mm-hmm. you know, the Charles Williams thing, and then eventually the thing with the with that's Lewis's right. wedding. So it'd just been a long time since they'd really spent a lot of time mm-hmm. together.
But his death clearly still really affected him.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, you know, I certainly have my own friends who, mm-hmm. you know, I've been very close with at different times, and you mm-hmm. know, it's, maybe we're not as close as we used to be.
Mm-hmm.
But I still care very much about them. And I know that if we just had a reason to hang out again, we'd hit it up right at, you know, again. And
oh,
so,
for sure. Yeah.
You know, if a person like that does, if you lose a person like that, it affects mm-hmm. you deeply.
It does.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah. Even if you haven't been in touch recently.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, but I also just like that because Tolkien's kind of like, for some reason, Williams got all this credit for, you know, for being influential on the space trilogy, but it was really me. I just love that. So.
Yeah. Yeah.
Anyway, so that's a couple of letters that that Tolkien wrote about Lewis's death. And then Edith's death was on November 29th, 1971, just a little less than 2 years before Tolkien's own death. And here's what Tolkien had to say in some of his letters about the death of Edith. So,
AKA Luthien.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
This is a letter to William Cater, and I'm not sure who that is. My dear Cater, I am grieved to tell you that my wife died this morning. Her courage and determination, of which you speak truly, carried her through to what seemed the brink of recovery, but a sudden relapse occurred, which she fought for nearly 3 days in vain. She died at last in peace. I am utterly bereaved and cannot yet lift up heart, but my family is gathering round me and many friends. There will be notices in Times and Telegraph. I am glad that you saw her still undimmed on Thursday, the 18th, I think, before she fell ill on Friday night. I shall treasure your letter of the 26th, especially for its last lines. Yours ever sincerely, Ronald Tolkien.
Hmm.
So I guess Cater was going to interview him for the Sunday Times, and it was supposed to be an 80th birthday tribute to Tolkien. So I guess it was just he was postponing or had missed an appointment.
Hmm.
And then Tolkien wrote to Michael again on 24 January 1972. So this would have been, you know, a couple of months after Edith's passing. And here's what he said. Make sure I got my right spot here. Where am I starting? Oh yeah. I met the Luthien Tenuviel of my own personal romance with her long dark hair, fair face, and starry eyes and beautiful voice. In 1909, so he's referring to 1909.
Mm-hmm.
And in 1934, she was still with me and her beautiful children. But now she has gone before Beren, leaving him indeed one-handed. But he had no power to move the inexorable Mandos, and there is no Dor Gyrth Ikuniar, the land of the dead that live, in this fallen kingdom of Arda, where the servants of Morgoth are worshipped. So, very grieved.
Ooh,
words.
Ooh, you made me cry.
Yeah, I mean, very... You know, he can tell this is 2 months after Edith's death, and he's still taking it pretty hard from what it sounds like.
Well, when you live your life with someone, you know, I mean, one-handed, that's a pretty, pretty big handicap.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, really, just a really, really beautiful words. And I don't know, it's so Tolkienian that he doesn't try to like kind of round it off with a happy thought, but he's mm-hmm. just kind of like, and now here I am alone in the land of the dead that live in this fallen, there is no, the land of the dead that live in this fallen kingdom of Arda where the servants of Morgoth are worshipped. Right. He's just like, looks around him and he's like, Edith was my companion through all my life. Mm-hmm. She was the person that could bring me out of the darkness. And now she's nowhere to be found in this dark land.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So, yeah, a beautiful, very Tolkienian tribute to his wife.
Absolutely. So, yeah.
To the love of his life. Mm-hmm. Beautiful. All right. And then Tolkien himself passed away on September 2nd, 1973. Reading what Carpenter has to say about it.
So he'd lived not quite 2 years after.
Right.
For two more years, yeah.
The end was swift. On the Thursday, he joined in celebrations to mark Mrs. Tolhurst's birthday, but he did not feel well and would not eat much, though he drank a little champagne. During the night, he was in pain, and next morning he was taken to a private hospital where an acute bleeding gastric ulcer was diagnosed. It so happened that Michael was on holiday in Switzerland and Christopher in France, and neither could have reached his bedside in time. But John and Priscilla were able to come down to Bournemouth to be with him. At first, the reports on his condition were optimistic, but by Saturday, a chest infection had developed, and early on the Sunday morning, 2nd September 1973, he died, aged 81. So, his Requiem Mass was held in Oxford 4 days after his death in the plain modern church in Headington, which he had attended so often. The prayers and readings were specially chosen by his son John, who said the Mass with the assistance of Tolkien's old friend Father Robert Murray and his parish priest, Monsignor Doran. There was no sermon or quotation from his writings. However, when a few weeks later a memorial service was held in California by some of his American admirers, his short story Leaf by Niggle was read to the congregation. He would perhaps have considered it not inappropriate. Before him stood the tree, his tree, finished. If you could say that of a tree that was alive, its leaves opening, its branches growing and bending in the wind that Niggle had so often felt and guessed, and had so often failed to catch. He gazed at the tree, and slowly he lifted his arms and opened them wide. "It's a gift," he said. So, I like that his American fans at their memorial for him read Leaf by Niggle.
Yeah, definitely seems appropriate.
Fitting tribute for him.
And how also very appropriate that none of that was at his Requiem Mass, because that would have been inappropriate. And we know that Tolkien was very traditionalist when it came to those things. And that reminds me, his son John was a priest. Yes?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Very cool.
I think I mentioned him. Did it mention him celebrating?
It did.
Yeah.
With the help of another priest, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So Christopher, from there on, Christopher carries on his father's legacy. It's probably a story for another time, but the story of Tolkien's life really can't be complete until the official publication of The Silmarillion in 1977. After all, it was the saga that served as the seedbed for the entire Middle-earth legendarium, the frame of the universe, the Hobbit, and The Lord of the Rings. One indeed wonders how much the unfinished work weighed on his mind as he lay on his deathbed. Hopefully not too much. And thankfully, Christopher would see it to completion and continue to unearth gems from his father's notes for almost another half a century. And Tolkien's legacy, as he might say, goes ever on.
So, indeed it does.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's good.
I wonder what he would just think, you know, of if he were alive today, what would he say seeing knowing that films based on his, you know, his masterpiece, his literary masterpiece, won the Academy Award for Best Picture.
Blockbuster successes.
I mean, I don't think he was really much of a Hollywood guy, but just being like, that's pretty awesome, right?
I mean,
even if you quibble with things in the movie, and then looking now here in 2020 or 2021 and saying, you know, that a company spent hundreds of millions of dollars for the rights to stories, to sketches of stories of his.
And based on a book that he had to beg people to publish.
Right.
And didn't even get published in his lifetime. I mean, that's kind of mind blowing.
Absolutely. It's truly wonderful. And, you know, and so, yeah, his road goes ever on.
And indeed it does. Yeah.
So that concludes our series on the life of J.R.R. Tolkien. We hope you enjoyed it.
Yes, we do.
All right. Did you have something else you wanted to say? Sorry.
No, I was just going to say that after you said that, you know, that Tolkien's road goes ever on, and I was going to say, indeed it does. And we're blessed to, you know, travel it, to be a part of it.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
All right. Well, that was a, you know, pretty long episode here.
Epic.
So we're going to cover a quick couple of tweets on some lore topics, because we haven't really talked much lore. We've been kind of short on the lore lately. And so I just wanted to get a little bit into some lore here at the end on a quick couple of questions that came through on Twitter. And these questions are from are from Chandler Gray over on Twitter. So Chandler, back on January 5th, sent us a note and said, Tolkien Road, love the pod. Question, does Tom Bombadil feel like a dead end? We get the story, and I always thought it would come back around. Never did. Doesn't seem like JRT would have left a string hanging like that. What did I miss? So it's a great question, Chandler. And I don't know if you listened to our episode on Tom Bombadil that we did a few months back. But I can totally understand why you see Tom Bombadil in this way. I think there are probably lots of, there are so many loose ends when it comes to Tolkien. Mm. That's actually something I love about Tolkien, right? Is all of the loose ends, like the threads that you're like, I wonder what's over there. Or I wonder what the real truth behind Tom Bombadil is. I think you need to, if you haven't listened to our episode on Tom Bombadil, you need to listen to that. And I think maybe that'll help some, because I think Tom Bombadil is not supposed to be kind of like a rounded off character in kind of the traditional storytelling sense, right? I think he is supposed to be something of an enigma, right?
Yes.
He's supposed to be this figure that just doesn't really, really compare to, you know, to all the other ones in the same way. I'd also recommend that you check out my book, Tolkien's Overture, because I spend a good amount of time in that book discussing, there's actually a whole chapter on Tom Bombadil, because the thesis of the book is that music plays this incredible role from the very beginning of the history of Middle Earth, and that Tom Bombadil is a very musical figure, right? He's almost kind of this embodied music that dwells in this weird place, the Old Forest, right? I think if you want to get a good answer to that question, you know, I think I'd listen to our interview with Keith Matheson from a couple of episodes ago on Tom Bombadil, and we cover a lot of the ground in terms of like the different theories on who Tom Bombadil is. And then I encourage you to just check out my book if you haven't already, Tolkien's Overture. And I do go into a discussion of my own kind of personal views on what I think is going on with Tom Bombadil. You know, but at the end of the day, I think there's just a lot of loose ends when it comes to Tolkien. I don't think he wrapped up everything that he wanted to, right? I think that's why he continued to write like appendices and those sorts of things throughout his life. Mm-hmm. And he continued to edit these stories because he was like, that doesn't quite do it, you know, and you know, what's going on over here?
Yeah.
Chandler also asked about the, he also asked about the Blue Wizards. And I'll just tell you, Chandler, yeah, the Blue Wizards are, they're one of those things that, he mentions a couple of places in kind of in passing, and everybody's like, why didn't you tell us more about the Blue Wizards? Right. We just don't know much, right? We have very little information. We did do an episode on the Astari a long time ago, which is a chapter from Unfinished Tales, where he speaks a little bit about the Blue Wizards. But basically all we know about them is they just got sent into the far, they just kind of kept going into the east, right? And there's this whole thing about like there's stories to the east, that like there's places to these, stories to these, that we have no idea what was going on over there, right?
I kind of love that.
I do too, yeah.
Just, you know, it's great not to know everything, I think, in some cases.
Yeah, I feel like part of becoming, like getting really into Tolkien is just embracing that, right? That not every little thread that he opens up is necessarily going to come back around. Now, a lot of them do, right?
Yes.
I mean, it's not like he was sloppy necessarily. Mm-mm. But the question of making something seem real, of giving it that verisimilitude, I think loose ends are truly important in that, right?
Yeah.
Because real life, how many things do you witness every single day, if you're a little more attentive, how many things are you witness to just every single day that you're like, I wonder what's going on with that?
Mm-hmm.
Like just in our little bubble of a world that Greta and I live in, like we have our not large backyard. I mean, it's not tiny, but it's not like super big, but we get animals that come through our yard. You know, a couple of months ago, I was setting up a fire in our backyard and it's like dark and I see all this motion and there's like five skunks in our backyard. And I'm like, I've never seen skunks in our backyard before. And here they all, what's going on with that, right?
The miracle of that was that you didn't get sprayed.
I know.
That's like, still, I don't understand.
And, you know, we've had like foxes in our backyard.
Yeah.
We've had, deer in our backyard. So, you know, you'll just get in like each of those things has its own life, right?
Mm-hmm.
People you interact with, you know, there's people you pass at the grocery store. Each of those people has their own life. And you might witness one of them at the grocery store do something quirky one time. And you're like, I wonder what that was all about. But you never really stop to think about it, you know, look into it. But that's part of like, but that's reality, right? That's you being reminded for a brief second that not every, like, that the world
is so much bigger than you are.
It's so much bigger than just you.
Right.
Right. And it can be refreshing.
Very refreshing.
To experience that.
Yeah.
And
like, oh, it's not all about me after all.
Maybe Tom Bombadil and the Blue Wizards are a reminder of that. Right.
That's a really good point. Yeah. I like that. Yeah. Yeah. So, just a reminder of how big the world actually is and how small a piece you play in it. That that can be very freeing.
Yeah. Well, it's like what Bilbo says at the end of The Hobbit, right? I'm going to get the words wrong, but basically they kind of joke about the role that he, this little hobbit fella, played in these big events. And, Bilbo just kind of says, I'm very much paraphrasing here, but he basically says, I'm kind of happy just to be like not super wrapped up in all these things all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Right. I'm just a guy, right? I'm just a hobbit.
I'm just here
that prefers
living my life,
prefers to just kind of hang out and eat and smoke a pipe.
Yeah.
So,
to fly beneath the radar.
Anyway, Chandler, thank you for your questions.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry we can't give you more definite, concrete answers, but that's the reality of Tom Bombadil and the Blue Wizards is they are these loose ends that we'd all love to know. We all just like want to sit Tolkien down and be like, tell us more. We want to know exactly who the Blue Wizards are. We want to know their names, their powers. We want to know what they were doing for 2,000 years. We want to know all the stories. We also want to know who Tom Bombadil is once and for all. And I don't think Tolkien actually knew when he died who these people were.
And that could have been part of his point, too. You know, maybe he wanted his readers to fashion their own ideas about all these things. And I think that's cool.
I do, too.
If that was indeed his intent. But even if it wasn't, I still think it's cool.
Well, but that's part of the beauty of works like this, right?
Mm-hmm.
Is you get to kind of think about it. I mean, you know, basically, like, this Latron Prime being in the Second Age, like it's got, we know a good bit about the Second Age, but it's going to have a lot of freedom just to be like, tell you more about this particular person that you know very little about.
Yeah.
Right?
He's giving us the chance to be sub-creators, the opportunity to be, you know, sub-creators along with him. And I think that's nifty.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
All right. Well, that was a pretty epic episode there.
Yeah.
Greta.
It really was. Is.
So we'd love to hear from all of you. I've got a lot of backlogged correspondence. Do my best to get to everything I can here in a timely fashion. But keep it coming. You know, TolkienRoadPodcast@gmail.com, TolkienRoad.com, Facebook, Twitter, YouTube. Talk to us wherever you are. I did actually start an Instagram page this week.
You finally did it.
I did it, but I'm still figuring out how to use it. So,
we need to get our teenage
apparently
daughter
Instagram is supposed to be
us.
On your phone. Everything's supposed to be done on your phone, on the app on your phone.
Yeah, I think that's right because it's picture based.
And I'm like, I don't like doing social media stuff on my phone, right?
I think we just might need to hire our teenage daughter. She's way, apparently, she's got actually a bunch of followers on Instagram.
Oh, really?
Apparently.
Well,
so she knows what she's doing. And I don't even have an account, so I'm out of the running.
I have no doubt about that. So, all right. Well, that's it for this episode, y'all. Got some good stuff coming in the next couple of episodes. Don't forget that you can become a patron and watch the video of this episode if you are so inclined here now that you're at the end of the episode and you've already listened to it. If you want to go back and watch it now, you can. You can become a patron. And we want to give a shout out to all of our patrons, especially the following: Caitlin of Tea with Tolkien,
Lise U,
Andrew T,
Shannon S,
Brian O,
Emilio P,
Zeke F,
James A,
James L,
Chris L,
Chuck F,
Azia V,
Ish of the Hammer,
Teresa C,
David of Pints with Jack,
Jonathan D,
Eric S,
Joey S,
Eric B,
Matt L,
Johanna T,
Ms. Anonymous,
and Sam N. And we also want to give a shout out to those celebrating their Patreon anniversary this month. And this includes those who celebrate in December. Tyler W.
Shannon S.
Brian O.
Margaret L.
Emilio P.
Zeke F.
And Katie W.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you all so much,
very much.
For your patronage, for your ongoing patronage. Thank you to everybody who listens, and we'll talk at you next time.
Bye, y'all.
Bye-bye.